Okay, so before I switch gears, I mentioned timeouts. It just occurred to me. Watch, it won't have installed Boxygen and I'll be completely... It did install, okay, good. I mentioned timeouts and I didn't actually sort of finish the comment. Right? So the problem with timeouts is that there are no good choices other than zero and infinity. Look, if I'm talking to a disk drive, okay, and it's got a specified time after which I get to declare that the operation didn't happen correctly, what? The thing has got a 12 millisecond worst case seek time. Remember my rant about average seek time don't mean anything? I'll do it again. If you're supposed to get an answer in 12 milliseconds and 5 minutes have gone by and the disk has not responded something. So this is the case where you have a real-world event going on and having a timeout that corresponds roughly to the real-world specification, there's an objective reason why that's the correct timeout. But the problem is that for all other timeouts, second case, actually similar in nature, you have a real-time multimedia sort of a thing going on, right? If you do not get the frame produced in the next 1/30th of a second, it is not worth it. Move on. That's another well-motivated timeout. That one doesn't tend to get involved in the messaging system. If I have a server responding to you as a client, what's a good timeout? All the timeouts come from there. So, what's that? There is maybe a way to look at it, which is say, well, maybe I don't know what's a good timeout for the client, but I might know how long I'm willing to have the server hung out to dry. The problem is, then the system goes under load and the timeouts actually start triggering, and the likelihood of you figuring out what went wrong and who did what to whom and why is zero. The worst part of it is, the place where the timeout is going to occur in practice, right? It's not in the case where I'm willing to block. Willing to block means I'm willing to do the infinite timeout. That's where the timeout's going to hit you is in the return. And the problem is, that's after the operation has been done, and what you're returning is the answer. You don't get the answer. So the reason it matters what happens in the non-blocking case is, notice, you'll at least get enough information to know that the message was truncated. You'll get the status code. Now, observations. This leads to some design pattern issues when you're designing interfaces. Generally speaking, what you'll notice is operations tend to have significant payload going in one direction or the other, but not both. You'll ask for some piece of information and it will get returned. That operation typically will not involve mutating information in the service. It's a pure query. Or you'll do an update operation, and what you'll ask for back is a status result, not a vector of answers. Well, the status result is something that you can get reliably unless you break the protocol, you being the client, right? As long as you're receiving, I can guarantee you'll get the status result because that's in the registry. So that says if you design your protocol right, the update operations are not going to be the ones where you go astray. If you don't receive, it's on you. And then the query operations, the reason you don't want them to have side effects is because if something goes wrong, you can then reissue them. When is this a problem in practice? The rule is, the main case where it's a problem is the strings, because there's a bounded number of capabilities, and the protocol usually tells you how many are coming back. We do not often, in fact, IDL does not support a dynamic vector of capabilities. But the case where we do see trouble coming back is if you ask a question and you do not know the size of the answer that will be returned. For example, you do a database query, you say, get me all the records where the name field matches Fred. You have no idea how many records there are of that form, so you have no idea how many of those are going to come back. If you don't know what's coming back, it's not really possible to set up a reply string. You could get lucky, but in principle, there's no way to know how long the reply string should be. And if the answer is you're going to get back 5 records of 10 bytes each, you surely do not want to prepare to get 50,000 back. 5 million. There's just no good way to sort this out. So the observation is that this non-blocking thing is only an issue in reply, and it's only an issue in practice. It's an irritation, but it's only a semantic issue when you have a dynamically sized reply coming back. Now, the observation is generally, if you have a dynamically sized reply coming back, you don't want to get all of it at once. You simply want to do some kind of an iterating protocol. If you can convert that into an iterating protocol, you say, well, I'd like the next 50 answers. I'd like the next 50 answers. That doesn't work universally. So ultimately, there are cases where you just have to bite the bullet and deal with the dynamism. In those cases, there's a mechanism for saying, okay, at request time, what I'm going to do, I'm going to send you an address space. I'm actually copying the answers into the address space. It's my storage. Sending me back a string, send me back a capability to the address space. Now, is that a pain in the ass? You betcha. So the hazard of timeouts seems worse than the pain of this very, very obscure case, especially given that we can probably deal with it fully within capital without really exposing it. Another part of the protocol that's a problem is bounded strings, right? So there's a limit to how many bytes the kernel will move for you. The reason is we need a total bound on the time, and we would need more process states in order to be able to move a long string. So basically, what we would do, if you wanted the ability to move a really long string, we'd move it in chunks. Make a little progress, remember what we got, make a little more progress. That's trickier to do than it looked, and we're currently trying to figure out what to do with it. If you were tracking the Kapros dev list, which is the system derived from Eros that Charlie Landau's been working on, you'll see that he's been working on a variant design for that, and it's a tricky design. Because so he's got a nice idea for how to do long strings, which is, look, if I'm willing to block for a reply, then what I should do is I should send you some kind of an object. And what this object is going to give you is the right to copy out of my space. You're going to do that copy from user level. As you're going to do that copy from user level, the kernel doesn't have to worry about ping-pong while the string is moving, right? It just doesn't move the string. It's up to you to pull. Once the sender is willing to block, it works fine. Fortunately, his design says, but if I'm doing a non-blocking send, I can't use that mechanism. Why? If I'm doing a non-blocking send to you, part of what I'm saying is I'm not going to have you tamper with my control flow. But probably another part of what I'm saying is I don't trust you. And if I don't trust you with respect to my control flow, I probably also do not trust you with respect to you'll tell me when I can release the buffer. I need to know the operation's over. I can't rely on you to tell me the truth about when you're done with it. So now we're going to get back into something like a timeout at application level, which is basically, well, so when do I say to hell with you and kill the buffer? And the answer is, well, you'll pick an answer, right? The problem with picking an answer is it's arbitrary, and there will be the well-founded client that's actually trying to behave that will get screwed up this way. And these things, when you make them asynchronous, become almost impossible to debug. So you don't have a good answer here. The idea that I should send an object back and forth is good. The notion that I should have to do an extra copy to deal with that object is a pain. Another thing I wanted to talk about, unrelated to that briefly, is I gather some of you have been inquiring about small spaces. What are they? What are they for? So let me take a brief minute to explain that. On the Pentium and on one or two other architectures, there are two ways that you can restrict the range of addresses that an application can assert. The first is with the virtual memory system, right? You can control what pages are mapped. The second is with the segmentation system, because the segmentation system can impose a base and a bound on the references. And if you're really careful, you can contrive things so that the actual address space might look like this. The application space is going to go 0 to 3 gigabytes. I apologize for being out of scale here. The kernel is going to take the top. What we're going to do is we're going to chop this piece into small spaces. If you have an application that fits in 128 kilobytes of total virtual memory, it can be assigned into one of these little chunks and arrows. The way we deal with this from a standpoint of protection is normal applications, it is their segments that limit them to 3 gig. That's what stops them from looking into the small spaces. Small spaces, for their part, run in 128 kilobyte segment. And the reason we do this is that it often allows us to switch from one process to another without having to reload the address space, the master address space pointer. And reloading the master address space pointer is incredibly expensive, like a factor of two in a typical IPC. Factor of two doesn't sound like a lot until you realize that you're doing a lot of IPC. So that's why the mechanism originally went in. Actually, it was, the idea came from L4. Norm Hardy and I had talked about it years before but not done it, and Jochen did it, and then we borrowed it back. So that's one sense of the term small space. And that's where it came from. There's another sense in which we use the term small space. And the reason I had not wanted to talk about small spaces in Kyotos is that these two things are conflated and we need to tease them apart, and we haven't had a chance to do it. So it just seemed ripe with opportunity for confusion. The second notion might better be called an unkept or unhandled space. This is a space that does not run with any sort of address space fault handler. Why would I want one of those? I might just want to keep my resource requirements low. Address space fault handler certainly must not rely on the address space fault handler, or at some point that idea would have to stop. So there are certain processes that basically have to run without any assistance at all. And conversely, those processes that run with assistance, like ELF space, so if I'm going to have a handler that's going to manage my space for me, it really needs to own the structure of my space. Right? It needs to know that my space consists, well, it's very helpful if it can know that my space consists of GPPs arranged in a certain way and that there are pages at the bottom. And the handler knows the algorithm that was used to fabricate the space, and knowing the algorithm that was used to fabricate the space, it's entitled to make assumptions about the structure of the resulting graph. So, for example, it doesn't bother to check whether there might be an entry capability in some slot. It knows there's no entry capability because it didn't put it there and it controls the space. But typically, the top-level GPT capability of an L space will be an opaque capability. Right? I will not be able to inspect the tree hierarchy. I'll be able to look at the data, but not the metadata. If I'm going to manage the space myself, it can't be opaque. I have to have the ability to update it. This leads us into a notion where there are two styles of building address spaces. One is, I assume I'm going to have a handler, and the other is, I assume I'm going to do all the work myself. And I built the structures slightly differently in these cases. From a pragmatic standpoint, there are two use cases for these self-managed spaces. The first is space managers. The second is drivers. And the driver case is going away soon, but let me explain why it comes about. Often, a driver has to memory map a physical memory region. And in order to do that, it basically has to take some space that fully understands the bounds on, right, and kind of jack it up and build up some structure, and then add a physical memory mapping, which is what Text Console is. That's why Text Console is a small space. Not because it's a small it's not because it doesn't need big space. And that's actually a good reason to make it a small space, but that's not why we did it. We did it because knowing the constraints of the small space tells us how we can manipulate that space to map it. Because at the time that we did it, L space did not provide sufficient support to map new regions at other locations. And that's either there or it's coming. And the production version of Text Console will use L space. So how did these two things get conflated? It turned out that most of the applications that used unkept spaces were small. And the reason is, you know, if you're doing all of the, if you're holding up your pants with one hand behind your back and only have one hand free, writing a lot of code that's trying to work with only one hand free is a recipe for disaster. These things tend to be small. They tend to fit in a small space. They also tend to be things where you had a main process and you had a handler that was small. And we somewhat arbitrarily said, look, the self-managed model, we're going to choose that it'll build an address space that fits the small space constraint, because then we get performance advantages. It turned out that there was 100% overlap between things where it was convenient for them to be small spaces and things where it was perfectly okay for them to run in this sort of self-managed way, because most of those things turned out to be little helper processes. An unfortunate result of that was that the term small space came to apply to both issues, which it shouldn't have. They really are orthogonal. And I didn't want to dig into all of that, which is why I basically sort of tried to steer people away from the small space question. So if you're asking what does the load small call do, load small builds a space that consists of a single GPT with pages in it. And the very early Bootstrap code, so if you were looking at the code that gets called from underscore start, you'll see it has the world's ugliest No, the world's second ugliest Bootstrap hack. It checks to see if there is a runtime startup hook pointer. Large space, this pointer is null. In a small space, this pointer is almost the first thing in the binary. And if it exists and is non-null, we simply jump to it. We do not call, because at this point we do not yet have a stack. The code that we call is actually responsible for obtaining the pages that get put in to become the stack. Once a stack exists, what that code does is it nullifies the runtime hook pointer and branches back to underscore start. So there's a piece of very ugly low-level manipulation so that these self-managing processes can construct their own stacks. Once they get past that stage, they behave more or less normally, except that if there's a memory fault, they're not going to tell anybody because there isn't anybody to listen. Needless to say, this is one of these kinds of tricks where a friend of mine when I was in grad school had a phrase she was fond of. She said, she would describe things as being robust to failure. Right? That is, they will fail with very high likelihood if you only wait long enough. It's the nature of the design that they will fail. So this kind of low-level trickery is definitely in the robust to failure category. And it's, you need it for some bootstrapping cases, but it's not really the way you want to run things. We're moving to a place where pretty much the only self-handling spaces in the system will be the space handlers themselves, the space bank, which is very peculiar because the space bank also can't call a space bank. The person who runs the next run does it all. And that may turn out to be it. I think about it, maybe that the constructors need to run as self-managed spaces. I'll be better. And everything else will run as rational processes. For those of you who are wondering about that, that's what's going on. Okay, so last week I walked through the path of what happens when one process is calling another, or rather is sending a message to another. The other half of that path is the path where I'm invoking a kernel capability. I want to try to look at that case today. This is why I like compilers. They do your syntax checking for you. You can't spell. Let me start here. Good one. Let me look at the GPT implementation, right? So if I'm invoking a kernel capability, there's sort of three phases to what's going on, right? There's a phase coming in where I'm going to set up my arguments and I make sure I've got everything I need, make sure that they're present so that if the kernel references them, nothing will go wrong. Then I'm going to call the operation to actually implement whatever invocation is done. That's going to have output results, but the problem is that I don't actually know if there's a destination process to receive them. Okay. The rule is, it's as if I invoke some other process, and that process replied on the reply capability that I specified, which has to be an entry capability. If I don't provide an entry capability, there isn't going to be a reply, but the effect still has to happen. And unfortunately, there are two or three operations where I might have had a good reply capability on the way in, but by the time I'm coming out, it's no longer good. So here's an example. I call the range capability to destroy an endpoint object, and I pass in the reply position an entry capability to the endpoint that I'm about to destroy. And by the time we're on the way out, that entry capability is no longer valid. You peek ahead and notice that this case was coming. It's not worth it. It's a lot of code and slow down other paths. So we actually, there are three or four operations that have this property, and they're all of the form of some kind of destroy, right? Either I'm destroying an endpoint, or I'm destroying a process, or I'm doing a set registers on a process that causes it to have bad register values. I put an illegal segment value in the segment registers of the process. That process will not run. I certainly can't return to it. Or I could do an operation, so remember if I'm going to reply to this process, the process has to be in the receiving state. But suppose the operation I did caused it to be placed in the running state. Well, now it's not receiving anymore. And the kernel always does non-blocking replies. If the destination is not receiving, we're done. So we're a little careful about all of these cases to make sure that there's some three or four patterns that match this problem. We're careful to make sure that none of those patterns return a string. I believe it's the case, although don't hold me to this, I believe it's the case that none of those operations return a capability either. Because of that, basically what we do is we set up a return message in an in-kernel data structure. We're going to copy it out to late after doing a late validation. We're going to come into the kernel. We're going to set up the receiver optimistically, assuming the receiver will still be good on the way out. And these two or three operations are going to revalidate if they have to. So let me just show you what an operation looks like. Okay. So this iparam structure, this is the kernel's internal data structure that tells us what the invocation parameters are. Both what's coming in, and also the locations where things are going to go out. Okay. And part of the code that happens before this is setting up the iparam structure by copying things in from user state. One catch is, until we get into the actual handler, right, the kernel doesn't know, it doesn't have a list for, there are two ways you can design this. One is you say, well, I'll keep a list for each kernel operation, what are its parameters, and I'll check them early. The other is, well, the handler already has to check them, so I might as well just check them then. And that's the way we do it. So the very first thing we do, basically, is figure out what's the operation being invoked. And we do a big switch statement on the operation, okay, and we do a check. And the INV require args basically is saying, I'm expecting, in this case, you got to pass it the iparam because that's what it's checking against. And that second argument is how many capability arguments are expected. Let me get out of getLTV. SetLTV. So, INV require, okay, so there's a set of helper routines that fetch arguments out of the registers, right? You, the application, provided arguments in registers or in data words. We're now going to fetch them back out so that we can manipulate them in the kernel. For the most part, that's very simple. For 64-bit arguments, we need a convention about how they're presented at the interface. And so there's a set of helper routines that are like get iparam 32 or get iparam 16 or get iparam 64. One of the things that's hidden off in the iparam structure is an index value, which is what register we're reading next. And as you call this get iparam thing, it both fetches the value you asked for and it bumps the index to move it forward to the next register. It's necessary to do an alignment requirement. So like a 64-bit value on a 32-bit machine has to be aligned in an even register on some architectures. But iparam 64 handles that. It looks at what's the offset that we're currently looking at. The rule is, do not expect, you have to get the parameters in order left to right. In the order that the input parameters in the order that they appear in the call. There's a conspiracy here between the arrangement of parameters as organized by capital and the arrangement of parameters as expected by the kernel. Obviously, if you and I don't agree about where the parameters live, we're going to have a hard time communicating. iparam32 will proceed to fetch parameters, and it also checks whether enough words were provided. If you need three words of parameters and I only send you two, get iparam32 on the third parameter will fail. Fail means it will signal an error and it will raise an exception. What will happen then is you'll get back a request error result because you did not provide the correct parameters to this request. So we're doing parameter checking. We then basically check the capability parameters to make sure we got the number that was expected. On incoming parameters, we do not count the reply capability here because everything's supposed to have a reply capability. We do require that there be something in the reply capability slot. We're not going to deal here with whether it's in fact a reply capability. That was dealt with someplace else. And then in this particular case, okay, iparam icap is the, or icap.cap is the kernel's pointer to the internal data structure of the capability you actually invoked. And what it's grabbing here is the pointer to the target object, which in this case is the GPT. And set LTV is not hugely exciting. One requirement, though, is we're about to mutate the object in an externally visible way, so we better mark it dirty. If we're going to mark it dirty, in particular, if we're going to change the LTV, we may have addressing state, translation state, that got built from this GPT. If we change the LTV, all that state's now bad. We can validate it. Having done so, We have now reached the commit point, right? This is the point where all the checks are done, but the modification that we're trying to do hasn't happened yet. Invalidating the memory state doesn't count. All that can be rebuilt. After the commit point, we update the L2V field, okay? And we basically send back an invocation result that says, did it, it's okay. Nothing. The commit point doesn't do anything at all. The reason it exists is to document the point in each control flow path where you are no longer allowed to fail. We actually have some tools that do control flow model checking. So there's a short list of procedures which, if you were failing, those would be the procedures you'd be calling. We have a tool that does control flow model checking that says, after you call sched commit point, you better not be calling one of those. So actually, that call doesn't do anything at all. It's an inline procedure with an empty body. It exists for the purpose of supporting the control flow model checking tool and also for making the code a little bit self-documented. On the Eros kernel, I don't know what we're doing about this. Not an issue on the Eros kernel, there was a possibility that you might have done something setting up a memory region that would have whacked a page table entry. The problem is that page table entry might correspond to some string that you're about to read or write. And of course, then all of the effort of checking is now bad. So there was a global variable. If you whacked any page table entry at all, you would set this global variable to true. Now, the way into the kernel when you're starting the operation, you'd set it to false. And then if you set any page table entry at all, if you whacked it, you would set it to true. And in Eros, what commit point would do is would say, oh, well, I'm at the point where I'd like to start making modifications, but I noticed that somebody has whacked a PTE out from underneath. If I'm an operation that requires any manipulation of the string, I no longer know that my strings are good. At that point, what I should do is restart the operation. Because it's the nature of the PTE whacking code that if your state is actually good, you run it again. The second time through, it won't whack any PTEs. It is not good, and you run it again, it will build the PTEs that you need, and the second time through, hopefully, it'll converge. The argument that it converges, by the way, is problematic. Nothing in principle will stop you from doing this an infinite number of times if you're sufficiently unlucky. We actually know some properties of the cache sizes that make that impossible, but the argument that that's correctly handled is not at all straightforward. And in the Eros case, there was an argument to sched commit point, which basically was, well, am I actually using a string operation? Because if I don't give a damn, because I'm not going to use the strings, then I'm really not interested in whether the PTEs got whacked. In the Coyotes case, I think we're a little more aggressive about abandoning right at the point where we whack the PTEs. Okay, so what's the scienv result? Remember, there's that bit that says whether the result is okay or not. And in this case, we have an okay operation that doesn't return any values. So actually, the only thing we care about here is to say, oh, well, we are returning zero capabilities, and since we haven't actually put any outgoing words, we're not going to send any outgoing words. Contrast that with, so here's a case where we have a check, and I won't go through the check in detail, but notice that if the check fails, we're calling this INV error message. Well, INV error message is setting up the output fields in the iPerform structure to say, we are going to send an exception message. It's going to have a 64-bit single-value payload, which is the exception code. And that's the result from this operation. Right? So at that point, we're done, and we're going to return. Oh, the other thing that INV error message does is it calls sched commit point. Every path is required to call sched commit point at some place in the path for our check that we test. What about replying with values? So get L2V is a great example. It only returns one word, right? It returns the L2V value. So same protocol as before. In this case, we don't have any incoming arguments. We don't have any incoming capabilities. We're going to call the commit point, and we're going to put the answer, right? So put OParam32 is the opposite of get IParam32, right? It's advancing the index into the output registers and appending the result. Up how many registers in the output are needed, or outgoing data words, rather. So the mere fact that we called put OParam32 here basically appends the 32-bit value to the outgoing message in the right way. There are very, very few kernel calls that manipulate strings, and I will show you one of the few in a minute. I think there may be only one. Only one capability that does it, and in only one, one kind of a place. Is that true? No, that might be true. And here again, we say, well, okay, we put a data word, and then we say, okay, our result doesn't have any capabilities. Now, this INV result thing looks into the iparam structure and say, and how many words got put on the way out? I will set up the return value word to say how many words are coming back. It's a very low-level messaging protocol. Or rather, it's a set of manipulators for the very bottom layer of the messaging protocol. And that's pretty much what a typical handler looks like. The other case is you could have, ignoring strings, the other case is you could have capabilities involved. So, that looks wrong. Ah, okay, no, it's just misnamed. Get handler and set handler are misnamed. These are actually setting the bit that says whether the GPT is doing the handler protocol. Right. Okay. Get slot, right? This is one that returns a capability. Get slot just returns the capability in slot N of the GPT, whatever that may be. All right, it has one argument coming in, which is the slot. It has no capability arguments going in, which is why the second argument to INV require args is zero. If slot is too large, if you ask for slot 17 of a 16 slot GPT, we are not going to try to return that, sorry. You'll have to try Windows if you want answers to those sorts of calls. Let me know what they do. I'm curious. Okay, so we figure out what GPT you're actually manipulating, okay, and then we do this cap set, right? So cap set basically sets the target from the source. Now, there's something sleazy going on here, which is that we're overwriting the source capability fields of the iparam structure. This is a little tricky. Those are going to turn into the output fields by getting copied out. Prior to the commit point, the source cap slots of iparam are the incoming capabilities, if any. After the commit point, you can overwrite them. In fact, you have to overwrite them to get an outgoing capability to go out. Do not then try to use the one that's coming in. Now, you might say, well, boy, that's a really boneheaded thing to do, Shep. Why not just add a couple of more fields to the iparam structure? I'm waiting for some helpful person in the back to ask me why this boneheaded thing. Okay. The answer is, yeah, that would be cleaner. But it turns out that this no use after write can be checked by model checking, so we actually can error check this pattern. And it costs a fair bit of code to initialize capability slots, so setting up a couple of extras is not a desirable thing to do. So in this case, what we've done is we've taken a convention that is undeniably hazardous, and we've rendered it safe by using the checking tool to make sure that we don't step on the slot. Okay, now there's a catch, though, which is why we can't just return it in place. If the GPT that we invoked was a weak capability, we can't just return the item in the slot. We've got to downgrade it before we do. That's why we're checking the weaken. And now notice that in this case, the second argument to IND result is 1, which is saying we're returning one capability. This is what the actual handlers kind of look like. Set slot is the dual, and I won't dig into this too far, except to say in this case, we got a slot and the capability, right? The slot is where we're going to set. The capability is what we're going to set. There's one incoming capability, so that's why the last argument in the require args is 1. If you stare at a couple of these, the pattern will start to emerge. So let's look at what calls this. Because I'm not sure I will go so far as to say it's the fun part. And proc invoke cap. Okay, as we've done before, right? We've got to get the incoming invocation control word. We have to make sure the parameter block coming in is kosher, okay? If we're doing a send phase or a receive phase, there are those extra parameters that came in on the stack that we may have to save. We know at least who's doing the send. We don't yet know who's doing the receive, because if we're invoking an entry capability, the receiver is the guy on the other side of the endpoint. If we're invoking the kernel, the receiver is the reply capability that we're specifying. All right. If there's a send phase, let's figure out what we're invoking. And if we're generating a reply capability, have I talked about generating a reply capability? I have, but it may make more sense to connect it up again. The idea is, I have an endpoint on which I'm going to want you to reply later. I want to be able to manipulate that endpoint. I want to be able to free it. So I want to have an endpoint capability to it. I want to generate for you an entry capability that can only be used once. That's what this RC bit, IPW0 RC bit does. It says, I'm passing in the reply position of the message, I'm going to stick the endpoint capability, and I'm going to set this RC bit. The protocol is, if I set the RC bit, the kernel will replace that capability on the way through with the corresponding entry capability. And that entry capability will be initialized to the correct protected payload. That's how the reply capability gets fabricated. Okay, well, but that is exactly like it was in the last case, because we need to do that in either design. Okay, string length and checking, you know, all generic, okay. Now, remember, when we did tap prepare for invocation, if we were invoking an entry capability and that entry capability pointed to something useful, we were going to get back an endpoint pointer. So if we're going down this path in 872 where we have an endpoint pointer, we are doing the cross-process case. We may yet muddle it up for some reason, but we're not invoking a kernel capability, at least not on purpose. There are some corner cases where we may end up in the entry capability handler within the kernel because the entry capability wasn't good. And the only reason we went that way is that was the easiest place to do the error check and the rejection.
All right.
So, pass that. Other lines later, there's the else. I'm into the kernel capability invocation. This is actually not as bad as it sounds. This code may look suspiciously like the earlier code, but it's not. Okay, so this code is not preparing for invocation incoming. Not preparing the capability that I invoked. At this point, what we're doing is we're preparing the capability in the reply slot. So logically, the kernel is going to invoke that capability on the way back. This is that other non-existent hypothetical process preparing to do a send in reverse direction. Same logic that we used before. And this endpoint, in this case, and perhaps the name of variable was not well chosen, this is not the endpoint I'm invoking, because I'm not invoking an endpoint. The endpoint that's my reply endpoint, and the kernel's going to invoke to get back to me. Now, if I got one of those, it may not be one of those, right? I could fail to supply a reply capability. Oh. But if I did supply one, okay, I've got to prepare all the incoming parameters, right? The kernel may be sending me back capabilities. Actually, where to put them. Maybe sending me back a string. That does not get validated here. Because there are only two or three cases that do strings, those are validated in those cases. We didn't put that in the general path. What else? Okay. If I provided a number of data words less than one in my incoming parameters, then I did not supply an opcode. If I did not supply an opcode, it's going to be hard to decode the rest of the arguments. That operation is malformed, and so right off, I'm going to say, okay, if I didn't get the minimal number of parameters to even know what invocation I'm doing, it's not a good message, and I should just say so and give up. Let's just look at these curly braces and make sure I'm getting ahead of myself. So if I have an endpoint, I've got to do some validation. Otherwise, the assertion is I'm not going to reply to anybody. So one of the something else I should explain. In the handler, you saw iparam. Iparam is a pointer to this invparam thing, which is sitting on the stack in the capability system call procedure. It used to be a global, but now we're SMP safe, so it's got to be on the per CPU stack. So either there's a reply endpoint, or I'm not going to reply to anybody. If I'm not going to reply to anybody, life gets much easier. Some things I don't have to do in that case. Okay. If you didn't send enough arguments for me to figure out what the hell's going on, you know, heck with you if you can't take a joke. If you sent me enough arguments, by the way, this else case, this need not be an else, because, let's see, if I did INV error message, what's going to happen here? No, it needs to be an else case. Okay. Otherwise, you sent me enough that this might be a valid message. I make it into the handler, and you may not have supplied enough arguments, and the handler may bounce the message, but I can get as far as the handler. So at that point, what I have to do is basically I decode a couple of parameters in INVPRAM, right? IPW0, as a side effect, is going to tell me how many data words there were. The send length, right? How many bytes of string data are you sending in? And because I'm going to check that in the require IPRAM macro. Right? You sent a string, and I didn't want one. That's a malformed message. And I'm going to pre-extract the opcode. You could see that there were a bunch of handlers that actually were not yet taking advantage of this pre-extraction. That line to fetch the opcode went in late, and most of the handlers are not yet using that fact, so we're doing it redundantly in many cases. And I know what capability you invoked, because one of the things I did very early was the capability that was invoked was prepare. Right? That means in the in-memory form, I can get its type field. Well, the type field is not organized by accident. Type field serves, among other things, as an index into an array of function pointers. That's how we end up in the right handler. So we're going to take the type number inside the capability, I'm going to index into this vector of pointers, right? And I'm going to call the appropriate handler. So this is the call that's going to turn out to go into that GPT handler that we looked at a minute ago, assuming this is a GPT capability. And this gets built, this array, in the most disgusting way imaginable. If you look in OpStore, you'll see there's a captype.def. Captype.def consists of a bunch of macros wrapped around some keywords. Captype.def gets pound included in a couple of places, okay, and some ugly macro hackery thuggery goes around to basically build this array. So merely by updating captype.def, everything else will update in lockstep if we add a new type. And there's a convention, right? If the capability type is GPT, the name of the handler procedure is cap_GPT. That's how we get them associated. Also a good way to find them if you're wondering, hey, where's that handler? So now we have invoked the handler, right? We've now returned here, and the handler has put any outgoing message into the INVPRAM structure. It hasn't yet gone to the recipient, if any. Now what we're going to do is decide what to do with it. Well, if there is an invokee, legacy terms. I often now say sender and receiver. In Kikos and Eros, we refer to these as the invoker and the invokee. These are horribly cumbersome to pronounce, and we're trying to stop. If there is an invokee, I better have an endpoint that points to them. And since I prepared them long before, I know this invocation is going to go through. So I go ahead and bump the protected payload on the endpoint if we're doing payload matching. You're free to hand me your reply capability and not do payload matching. There's nothing that requires that you bump the protected payload. What bumping the protected payload gets you is a guarantee that you will get at most one reply or call. Care? Hey, you know, services do wonky things, and you don't want them doing wonky things to you as well as to themselves. You're done with the procedure reply, you'd like it to really be done. Okay, and at this point, we're going to start transferring fields into the output process, right? SetPW is actually a copy into the receiving process of the parameter word. In this case, the parameter word that's going to receive the protected payload. SetEPID, EPID is special because it's a 64-bit quantity, so we've got to handle it a little bit carefully. But there's a designated place in the receiver where the outgoing endpoint ID is going to go. However many outgoing parameter words we have, we copy them out. Those are the put O params, right? Here's where they're actually getting copied out to the output process. Or more precisely, they're getting copied into the output process's process structure such that later when we resume that process, they'll get picked up into the registers. Now, of course, there's a problem, which is,
In case 7 and
12. Okay, in a C-switch statement, has the property that the normal pattern is you say, well, if it's this case, do something, break. If it's this case, do something, break. You don't say break, it's going straight. So if the procedure that's replying said I sent four words, what we're going to do is copy them out. 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm looking at this realizing that there may be a bug here because I want to review this. There's an order of operations problem, which is, what I was thinking was, hey, wait a minute, we just updated some registers, And in particular, we might have updated the register that's describing where the return parameters go. A bit of a road hazard here. But that's actually not the case. What had me surprised was, wait a minute, why am I reloading OPW after using OPW to figure out where the data words are going to go? And the answer is, in spite of what it looks like, I'm not. Notice that this case statement does not include a case for zero. Right? Data word zero is the control word. And the control word that's going to go out is a mix of some fields that came in and some fields that are being returned. So what we have to do here is build the combined control word before we can return that. So what's happening here is I'm fetching the control word that the receiver put in, and there's some bits in it that I'm going to keep, and anything else in it I'm going to throw away. And then I'm going to combine into it the control word that came in. In this case, it's the control word that's coming out of the handler. That IMV result macro that you saw in each of those handlers is actually setting up a control word as if there were a sender that was setting up to send me that control word zero. So we're building the combined output control word. If capabilities are being sent by the handler and capabilities are being accepted by the receiver, okay, well, if you're sending four and I'm taking three, I get three. If you're sending three and I'm taking four, I get three. But for those that I'm going to get, why don't we provide them? Right? This is where they get copied out. The way you know that you asked for four and you got three is on output, the control word will tell you how many you got. And if you know what protocol you're running, you should know how many you should have got. On that, something's wrong. Okay. And so at this point, I know, in fact, I could have done this earlier. Basically, I'm going to set the control word going out. This basically is the missing case zero. I'm setting output data word zero, which is the control word. Okay, now, before we get to the interesting part. The common case, anyone who calls the kernel is the party getting the reply. I mean, usual pattern is you call the kernel, it gives you a result. Right? So that's the case we're expecting. What we have to figure out here is what to do in the other cases. You have to figure out who's going to get scheduled next. You may have to update run queues, ready queues. Okay. So if the invoker is the same as the invokee, that is, I'm calling the kernel, it's returning to me, we're done, and we can go ahead and receive it. Otherwise, it's possible that I invoke the kernel, and I said, I'm going to invoke the kernel, I want the kernel to reply to him. And I'm going to keep running. I'm not going to do a receive fix. Or maybe I will. That's not the problem. But as a side effect, he's going to end up running in addition to me. So if the invokee is not the invoker, we're going to try to start dealing with those cases, right? So one possibility is there is no more. Well, if there is still an invoker, and, I have to figure out, basically what we're trying to figure out is who's going to run next. If I'm not going to run a receive phase, I'm the sender. If I'm not going to run a receive phase, then we're saying, I want to keep running. Slice is not up. I should not be preempted by this operation. Okay, so donate says basically whether I'm donating the rest of my slice to the recipient. I'm not running a receive phase, I'm not donating. The assumption is if I don't want to receive, I want to keep going. I'm trying to figure that out here. And then in either case, the invokee should now be moved to the running state. If the invoker is also the invokee, this is a no-op, because the invoker is already in the running state. And the invokee gets added to the run queue, and according to the value of donated, either gets added to the front of the run queue, in which case it will get the rest of the slice, or to the back of the run queue, in which case it will wait its turn. Last argument basically says whether we're going to put you preferentially in the front of the run queue. This can be a problem, right? Because if the invoker is the invokee, we don't really want to put the invoker onto the ready queue because the invoker is running. And if you're running, you're not in the ready queue. But notice that if they're the same, that we bypass this whole exercise right here. One way to describe this is if you put enough options in the control word of anything, you can make the code arbitrarily complicated. And this code is far more complicated than it ought to be. Unfortunately, there are good motivating use cases for every one of these options. I would really love to throw some of them out. Receive phase. If there is no invoker, then the invoker does not perform a receive phase. Why might there be no invoker? Well, you might have destroyed the process of doing the invocation. That might have been the operation. The operation is now done, so the process is now gone. But assuming there is an invoker, and by the way, if there's no receive phase, there's also no copy out phase for the same reason. Otherwise, there's a catch that we've just updated the control word field of somebody, and it may have been ourselves, and you have to fetch it again. If we're doing a receive phase, then we are done with the send phase, so say so, and update the bit to say that we're done with the send phase. If for some reason we restart the operation, we don't want to send again, okay? And enter the receiving state. That's a bit tricky. Whenever we enter the receiving state, we have to check and see if there are pending notices for us. Notices are like signals, except they don't preempt you. But the next time you enter a receiving state, you will get a message synthesized by the kernel telling you that there's a notice for you. Here we are entering the receiving state. If there are any notices, we've got to take them immediately. And if we were to dig into proc deliver soft notices, we would see that it will do a funny up call as if we were making it look as if we were receiving a message. Well, if we're not going to take soft notices, and by the way, after it does that, it abandons the transaction because we're now running again. If there are no soft notices, well, now I'm in the receiving state. Problem is, you may be trying to send to me, and you may have been forced to wait until I enter the receiving state, so I have to wake you up at this point. Anytime I enter the receiving state, every process has a receive wait queue, which is the queue of people who are waiting for that process to receive. Not receiving, try to send to me, you're willing to block, you end up on the receive wait queue. What we're going to do here is wake them all up. Those processes are then going to enter a mad scramble to figure out who's going to win to send me a message. As long as there's only one of them, that's fine. There's 100,000 of them, this could get ugly. Back to that. And then I'm now done because I can't make any further progress, so now I'm going to abandon the system call that's in progress. Note that at this point I'm in the PRS receiving state. By abandoning the transaction, I will not go back onto the ready queue. At this point, I will go idle, or more precisely, I will go receiving, but I won't say I'm in queues until somebody's ready to send it. I can be paged out in this state. I sit around long. So let's tackle the thundering herd issue. There's a term. You wake up a queue, there's 1,000 processes blocked on it, right, and they all scramble for a processor, and of course 999 of them fail to get it. Because there is only one of those processors. And this is sometimes referred to as the thundering herd problem. Now that we know about this problem, why do a wake all? Why not just wake one? You fear. We have a priority system. Okay, so and the priority system basically tells us what fair means. Or actually, it tells us a policy for being unfair. It's okay to be unfair as long as you're unfair on purpose. I'm trying to explain that this is not true to my 3-year-old. We're having about the same amount of luck that the kernel had. So you can imagine that I would wake up the highest priority process. There's a problem buried there. But let's assume for a minute I'm going to wake up the one highest priority process, because that's the one who ought to win the race. What would be the problem if anything? What could go wrong? You always have to ask, what could go wrong? Let's wait. What am I hoping that process is going to do when I wake it up? I'm hoping it's going to wake up and send me a message. The whole point is it was waiting for me to receive, right? The reason I'm waking it up is so that it can send. Do I know it's going to send me a message? No. It's sending a message. So if this process exists, it isn't destroyed. Part of destroying a process, if that process is on a queue when we destroy it, it does come off the queue. Important little detail there. Right. But indeed, I don't know that this process is going to send a message. Why not? Right, but that's a slightly different case. That is, it tried to send a message and the act of sending a message failed. If I can get that far, at least I know who it was sending the message to and I can wake up the next guy. The hazard is, I may not get far enough to wake up the next guy if this guy goes out to lunch. How could he go out to lunch? What is it that would, imagine he's going to do a sin, right? What would cause him to do a sin? What does it mean to do a sin? I'm a process, what do I do to a sin? When you resume a process, what does it do? What's the first thing it does? It takes it back to user. It executes an instruction, right? What instruction does it execute? It doesn't know what instruction to execute. First off, last, how does it know where that is? Okay, what part of the process did? instruction pointer or the program counter, depending on who built the CPU. So when I say I'm going to wake this thing up and it's going to send, what I'm really saying is I have some reason to believe that its instruction pointer points to the system call instruction, and that system call instruction involves an entry capability, and that entry capability points to this guy who just went to receiving state. How many of those statements could be false? All of them. How many could have changed the registers of this process in such a way the program counter points someplace else? I could have overwritten the capability register in such a way that it no longer contains an entry capability. How many could have overwritten the register set in such a way that the invocation control word no longer contains an opcode? How many could have overwritten the endpoint in such a way that the endpoint no longer points to this process at all? Now, if this process that we just woke up has the grace to affirmatively make a left turn and go someplace else, you can imagine sprinkling the kernel with, oh hell, did we take a left turn checks? The effect of which would be to go wake up the next guy. Unfortunately, there are many ways to go left without intending to go left. There's a problem that if we only wake up one process of the receive queue, that process might not cooperate, and then the other guys would be left stranded dangling, right? Because we've already woken up. We've woken up the winner, and the winner turned out to be a loser. How do we know that we need to go back? In Kinos, there was something called the worry queue. The way this worked was you would wake up one and you would put the rest on the worry queue, and if the rest of them didn't somehow wake up pretty soon, you would go do something about it. But this is one of those ad hoc policies that I love to hate. There was a paper design in Arrows that said, oh, well, when I wake somebody up off of a receive queue, what I can do is I can record a pointer to the queue that they were on, or to the process that they're supposed to be invoking. And then if they end up asleep someplace else, or if they end up making it out of the kernel without invoking that process, I'll go wake up the next guy and do the same thing to him. But there's a problem here with lost wake-ups. No really good way to resolve it. This pointer trick actually does work. We have not yet had a compelling use case that is properly standardized. The reality is, you very rarely see more than one process block. In this case, we decided to hell with it, eat the thunder and hurt. But you could contrive scenarios in which you would wake up 1,000 processes this way, right? And then they would all chew up pieces of CPU, not making a lot of progress. Ultimate result of which would be 999 of them would end up right back on that receive wake queue. There's another problem. Yeah.
Sorry, I just want to make sure I understand. You wake them all up. That puts them, one gets the processor.
No. You wake them all up means 1,000 processes migrate from this queue to the ready queue. Now you dispatch the processor, one of them comes off the ready queue. Let's assume it's one of the 1,000 because we're not really interested in the non-participants.
That one goes off and does something.
Does something. The problem is we don't know what it's
going to
be.
Right. But now the other 999 are eventually going to, given enough time, are eventually going to hop on the processor and then hop back on this.
Well, they may hop back on this receive wake queue and then they may make progress. It depends on what's the sequence of events after that. But yes.
Okay.
But the problem is, so there's an interesting catch, which is that these things are now candidates to run. Now, in order to run them, we're going to bounce them all the way back to user land to re-execute their send instruction. And then we're going to do a fair amount of kernel work, right? And in the end, they're going to end up back on this receive wake queue. Because the one thing I can tell you is, if you have a receive wake queue with 1,000 processes on it, you have a bottleneck. Bottlenecks are stable states. Right? Once a bottleneck, always a bottleneck. So it's sort of an, I mean, I can name some other cases, right? But okay. Now, fine. Notice that, okay, there's a catch here, which is, so what about when the receive phase is done? Notice that nothing here marks the receive phase done. This is a little puzzle. Your receive phase is finished as a consequence of my successfully sending to you. Turning off your RP bit is done from the sender. They reach across and turn it off. You don't see it here because it's not here. You will then wake up, you, the receiver, will then wake up, and you'll do the copy-out phase. The copy-out phase is something I really wish weren't here, right? All it's doing is taking a few parameters that didn't fit in registers in the receiver and copying them back up to the receiver stack. Okay. And then we mark that the system call is done. Now, the reason this is here is we have here what's called a boxcard system call. There are really three system calls here: send, receive, copy-out. We're contriving to do them in sequence, and we're using these control bits to figure out which ones that we've done. So on some machines, the program counter then has to be advanced Because we have to know basically whether when the process restarts, do we want it to re-execute starting at the second boxcar, or do we want it to go on to the next instruction? So this marker is telling us, yeah, we're now really all the way done and we want to go on to the next instruction.
Okay, receive queue. What's the other problem with receive queue?
So the supposition was, the fairness question was asked, or the unfairness question was asked, and the supposition was, well, you should wake up the highest priority process. Which one is that? It's the one, depending on your scheme, with either the highest or the lowest priority number, right? So you could imagine that when I go on to the queue, I will go on to the queue in some order that reflects my priority at the time that I go on to the queue. But real priority systems are dynamic. And the consequence of that is, I don't just go onto the queue and stay logically in my current position. I go onto the queue and my priority changes. When it changes, I have to alter my position in the queue in some way, or I need some data structure so that as I'm on a queue, I can change my order in the queue so that I can bubble to the front or bubble to the back or whatever is possible. And it turns out to be a data structure problem to find a process that's not on the ready queue in order to alter its priority. And the good thing about priority manipulation is if you're not eligible to run, we don't really care what your priority is. So normally, the only queue we have to look at to juggle priorities is the ready queue. This system, if you're on a receive wait queue, we might well want to juggle your priority because if we're going to do this wait one protocol, we need to know who to wake up. There's kind of an interesting design problem there that's currently, I can think of two or three kinds of solutions to it. This is one of these problems where it's only worth solving if you think you're going to see the thunder and herd problem. Because if there's only two guys sleeping, it really doesn't matter what the priorities are. So this is something we currently are not doing. Once you do that PI syscall done update, we're going to go on to the next application instruction. That's it. So I want to point something out about this path. Right? In a Unix system, as in this system, there's a common pattern to system calls. Right? At the bottom level, the system call parameters go in certain registers or they go in well-known locations in the stack, much like this system. A little bit of multiplexing to find out what the system call is, fine, much like this system. One important difference. With the exception of fork, which is a deeply magical system call, all system calls return to the caller or they don't return at all. That was the other counter tip. If you invoke a system call, there are two ignoring fork, there are two possible outcomes. One, it returns to you, either with an okay result or with an error. Two, you die. There's no funny processing about invoking the kernel and returning to somebody else. In fact, the only operation at the Unix kernel interface that a process can perform is call and reply to me. This system, the call and reply is ultimately broken down into two separate message send operations logically. And the kernel has to respect the protocol. Figuring out who we're replying to is a little more tricky. And the path that we've walked through this week and last week is not optimized. So that in practice, if you call the kernel 999 times out of 1,000, we're going to be replying to you or to nobody. People are replying to a third party, which is a very low likelihood case. It turns out to be a case that we can cherry pick early. Because if you're not returning to you, you're not going to set the RC bit. If you set the RC bit, there's still ways you can mess up the protocol, but we know you're trying to return to you. So eventually, this part of the path will get broken down into a couple of specialized versions that do fewer checks by cherry picking the common cases early. You look at this and say, oh, this seems awful complicated. I'm afraid it gets worse. Questions about any of this? I know this was sort of a long run. But you've now actually seen, well, there's a copy capability system call. But aside from that, you've actually now seen essentially the entire mechanism. Start off saying, well, we bring the machine up, and then capability indication. Now, that goes, maybe one that does a string. Any questions about this? The things that you can do if you're trying to debug a message, right? Go in and stick that statements in here. Get the kernel to tell you what's going on. If you wish to do that, if you go down into Arch i386 kernel and look at console.c, let me show you where the call is made so you know how to hunt it down. Back to kernmain for a minute. Kernmain is not enormously complicated, right? What does this if-def bring up? Right? So basically the deal is, once I start the first application process, I have to assume that it has taken over the display. And if I'm the kernel, I got to stop talking. In production, we would detach the console. And what that does, normally if the kernel does a printf, it's actually printfing to the kernel message log. And at the bottom of that, there's a put character routine. And initially, that put character routine both appends to the log and appends to the console. At this point, we stop appending to the console on the assumption that an application is taking it over. For debugging purposes, I introduced a hack that says, we won't stop appending to the console, but we will start only using the bottom five to four lines. And you may have noticed that text console has a hack in the top of it that says, actually, I'm not going to use the bottom few lines of the display. This is an agreement to share by conspiracy. If you're not using text console, which for many of your test cases you might not be, a reasonable thing is to take out the sifdef. Or if you want, I can very quickly add an option in the kernel command line to basically say no detach. Why would you want that? Because those kprintfs go to the kernel log. And if there's only three or four lines, they're hard to see. If you're using GDBean, there's this print message buffer thing that you can use to get them. How many of you have tried to use print message buffer and not been able to get it to work? How many of you have no idea what I'm talking about? How many of you have already gone out for a beer? How come you didn't invite me? You feel so left out. Seth?
You don't care.
But, you know, one option is not to shrink, right? Don't do the detach, just turn this whole thing off, right? And then don't use text console when you can see the printf. Because there have been cases where somebody has said a bug, I'll bring it up under GDB, and simply by printing the message buffer from GDB, right, I can see a few messages that went past before the victim saw them, right? And sometimes I'll know immediately what's going on, and sometimes I won't. But you can instrument this code. If you modify it, you can tell me. Get it to tell you what's going on. Another option, and I should work on this actually. We did the initial messaging output to the console mainly because that was the easiest, fastest thing to do. Not be a big leap to direct it to the serial port. And QEMU can be made to spit the serial port to standard out, and then you wouldn't have to fiddle with text console anymore. Do people find that helpful? Well, the problem is you're losing the kernel messages because there's only like a three-line window at the bottom.
But using that,
you've been able to use print message buffer, this is survival.
What does?
Like, you know, print message buffer format.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. So part of the issue is we're going to bring up a graphical console pretty soon, and at that point, this hack won't work anymore. Actually, I'm leaning towards doing the serial support. And for that reason. But Nate, were you trying to add something?
Just a point. I actually find it more convenient. Also makes it faster.
Well, I guess is this makes you a universe of one. Since you're nice, I won't suggest that people should go to you for help. Although they do anyway. Okay, any questions about any of this? I will send out mail, but with regard to the null stream and zero stream assignment, it is time for this to be done. Only many of you have not got it working. That's okay. I will send out a note probably tomorrow morning describing what I want Camden in, but that's mostly going to be, here's where I want your repository to be so I can look at what you're saying. I'm going to want to know the name of your test case. If your test case is not working, I want a description of what's not happening that you think should be happening, where you think it's not happening. I want that for two reasons. One, hey, something may jump out that's easily fixable. Two, we may find a bug, okay? But we need to call a halt to this. And third reason is that I want an opportunity to look over those things on Wednesday so that Thursday night I can do a session and maybe try to address some of those issues after I figure out what they are. But if I don't know what they are, it's very hard to speak to them. And what I'm gonna do on either Thursday or Friday is send out the next step, which is the pipe screen. One thing people are frustrated, it is frustrating to work on a system that's in the early stages and coming up. And it is not unexpected that people would run into snags, and especially with the wonderful development support that the system provides to us, it's It's really not surprising that some people have this stuff. Another thing is, if you've got Nullstream working but not ZeroStream, I want to know that. Where the files are. I will write this up, but this will at least give you a sense of what I'm looking for to be handed in. Mostly just where did you shove stuff?
What state are you in?
I'm expecting a big long write-up. I would like, if you're stuck, I would like enough of an explanation to clearly understand where you are stuck. Call it a day.
I think I know what you were talking about when you were talking about Kate Printup blowing away my return buffer.